content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 23rd, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. France confronts homegrown terrorism. What happened? Paris resembled a war zone this week as the French government deployed 10,000 troops and 5,000 police officers to potential terror targets around the country, following 3 days of terrorist attacks that left 17 people dead and sparked global debate on free speech and the growing threat of homegrown Islamist extremism. The unprecedented show of force, which saw heavily armed soldiers guarding tourist attractions, transport centers, synagogues, and mosques, came after French security services killed three militants in two separate sieges last week. First, police stormed a printing warehouse in Dammartin-en-Gaule, 20 miles north of Paris, shooting dead Sharif and Saïd Kaouchi, the two brothers who murdered 12 people last week in an attack on the Paris office of satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which had repeatedly run cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad and mocking Islamic extremism. Shortly afterward, officers stormed a kosher supermarket in Port de Vincennes in eastern Paris, where they killed Amédée Coulibaly, who murdered four Jewish shoppers and a policewoman. Coulibaly belonged to the same terror cell as the Kaouchi brothers. This week, the Yemen-based al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula claimed a responsibility for planning and funding the Kaouchi's attack as vengeance for the Messenger of God. French police are still hunting for six other members of the cell, including Coulibaly's wife, who is believed to have escaped to Assyria. The threat is still present, said French Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who declared that France was at war against jihadists and terrorism. Earlier in the week, French President François Hollande led more than 40 world leaders and 1.5 million people on a unity march through the streets of Paris. The rally, the largest on French soil since the liberation of Paris in 1944, was attended by premiers, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and British Prime Minister David Cameron. The White House said President Obama did not attend for security reasons, but admitted it should have sent the Vice President or Secretary of State in his stead. This week, Charlie Hebdo published its first issue since the attacks. In its initial print run of 3 million copies, 100 times its normal readership, sold out within hours. The cover cartoon reprised the Muhammad caricature that originally made the magazine a target of Islamists, with the weeping prophet holding up a sign saying, "Je suis Charlie," the social media slogan being used to express solidarity with the magazine. Beneath the headline, "All is forgiven." What the editorial said. The biggest question raised by Paris is whether it presages a new offensive by homegrown jihadists, said the Wall Street Journal. It's tempting to think that France, whose Muslim population of 6 million is the largest in Europe, has a unique jihadist problem. But while the U.S. has historically been better at assimilating diverse ethnic groups, extremists can now radicalize anyone with an internet connection. The fact that President Obama didn't think it worth flying to France for Sunday's Unity March highlights just how much he underestimates the nature and scope of the Islamic threat. These blood-curdling attacks highlight the difficulty of preventing assaults by militants who blend in among fellow citizens, said the Washington Post. The fact that all three militants were very much known to France's security services raises some reasonable questions about their procedures. But hundreds of French citizens have traveled to the Middle East to support extremist groups. In a democratic society, it is not easy to continuously monitor all of them. The greatest danger is that more Europeans will come to the conclusion that all Muslim immigrants are carriers of a great and mortal threat, said the New York Times. Anti-immigrant feelings in Europe were already at a dangerous level, as evidenced by the growing popularity of far-right parties such as France's National Front. As France licks its wounds, it's crucial that Europe's leaders emphasize that extremism is not inherent to the Muslim faith. What the columnist said, "The real danger in Europe is not to Muslims," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "It's to a small and increasingly vulnerable Jewish population. The fact that Koulibaly targeted a kosher supermarket was no coincidence. It was because the very existence of Jews angers Islamists just as much as offensive cartoons do. With anti-Semitic sentiment on the rise, an exodus of French Jews is already underway," said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. While in 2012 there were only 1,900 immigrants to Israel from France, an estimated 10,000 are expected to leave this year, and probably many more after last week's attack. "These attacks have created a really real challenge to Western liberal values," said Mark Ambinder in TheWeek.com. "If I write on my Facebook page, 'I think Charlie Hebdo ought to be punished for its desecration of the prophet,' should I be placed under intrusive surveillance or even arrested and questioned? What is the proper balance between freedom and safety? This is a debate France will now have." French officials admit they're unsure how to proceed, said Scott Bronstein and Arwood Damon in CNN.com. Jean-Charles Brossard, head of the French Center for Analysis of Terrorism, says there are an estimated 3,000 to 5,000 radicalized Muslims in the country, some having trained in Yemen, Syria, or Iraq. "To monitor their movements, their internet activity, and their contacts," Brossard said, "France would need 25 agents for each suspected terrorist, or up to 125,000 agents in total. As one counterterrorism official put it, "There are far too many of them and far too few of us. We cannot possibly keep track of them all." Turn now to our controversy of the week. Charlie Hebdo slaughter. Is Islam itself to blame? Charlie Hebdo prided itself on being non-denominational in its satire, said George Packer in NewYorker.com. "The irreverent weekly lampooned Catholics, Muslims, Jews, and public figures with equal crudity and venom. But when gunmen slaughtered 12 at the magazine's Paris offices last week, no one was surprised to find out that the killers shouted, 'Allahu, Allahu Akbar.' Yes, most Muslims were horrified by the massacre, but today a substantial minority of Muslims subscribes to an extreme and totalitarian version of the faith. It's not an act of bigotry to acknowledge that we're living through an astonishing surge in Islamist killing around the world. Let's stop pretending terrorism has nothing to do with Islam," said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. "It's the Islamist fanatics of Boko Haram, who just murdered 2,000 people in Nigeria, and the savages of ISIS, who have slaughtered thousands in Syria and Iraq. Every religion has its extremists, and centuries ago, Christianity bloodied its hands with the Inquisition and the Crusades. But today, right now, when it comes to religious violence, there's really only one game in town. That's too glib and simple-minded, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. It's unfair to hold up two French Muslim brothers as representative of a complex and diverse religion of 1.6 billion adherents. Let's not forget that terrorists also killed Mustafa Urad, a Muslim copy editor for Charlie Hebdo, and Ahmed Merabet, a Muslim policeman. Lassana Bathily, who hid 15 people at the kosher supermarket, is also a Muslim. There was nothing Islamic about the Charlie Hebdo massacre, said Iman Faisal Abdul Rauf in New York Daily News. Islamic law expressly forbids anyone to wrong another person more than he has been wronged. If the killers were deeply offended by Charlie Hebdo's cartoons, the proper Islamic response would have been to draw satirical cartoons of their own. Their acts make them apostates. Actually, there is no real Islam, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Since there is no central authority like the Vatican, there are many Islams, including the fundamentalist Wahhabi Salafi jihadist strain that first took root in Saudi Arabia and has infected much of the Sunni world. In France and other European countries, Muslim immigrants were never required to adopt Western values of tolerance, free speech, and secularism, which is why so many of them feel a huge amount of ambivalence about the war between the jihadis and the West. For the West to win, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon.com, we must remember that terrorism is essentially a political act, not a theological one. ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and other terrorist groups that inspire and fund attack on Western civilians are trying to spark a backlash against Muslims by Europe's right-wing, anti-immigrant parties, which would prove the radicals' paranoid claim that Muslims are uniquely hated and uniquely persecuted by the West. The radicals know that a clash of civilizations will result in more young, alienated Muslim men joining terrorist cells in Britain, France, and Germany, and heading for the battlefields of the Middle East. We shouldn't take that bait, said Max Root in CommentaryMagazine.com. The real war is within Islam itself. If we react to terrorism by adopting an us-versus-them narrative and blame all Muslims for atrocities like the massacre at Charlie Hebdo, we are playing into the terrorists' hands. Well, it was a good week for stamina after former Miami Dolphin Rob Conrad swam 9 miles to shore after falling off his boat during a solo fishing trip off the coast of Miami. I just said, I'm not dying tonight, Conrad said of his 16-hour ordeal. It was a good week for taking the call after a 3-year-old Salt Lake City boy was trapped alone in a car that was stolen and abandoned. When police called a cell phone left in the car, the boy answered and followed instructions to honk the horn until he was found. And it was a good week for getting bumped after an airport mix-up left a New York City man on a flight back from Cleveland with just one other passenger. There were no screaming babies, no one reclining their seats, said Chris O'Leary, who fully reclined his own seat. But it was a bad week for Stephen Emerson, a Fox News expert who said Birmingham in the UK is a Muslim-only city and a no-go zone for non-Muslims. In fact, 80% of the city residents are non-Muslims. It was a bad week for the nanny state after Texas's new agriculture commissioner announced that school kids could bring cupcakes to school to celebrate birthdays in a show of defiance of federal nutritional guidelines. The new rule, said Commissioner Sid Miller, is about providing local control to our communities. And it was a bad week for big surprises after a North Carolina man, Zia Segul, snuck home to give his wife breakfast in bed and triggered the alarm system. She thought he was an intruder and shot him in the chest. I'm good, said Segul after a trip to the hospital. On the briefing page this week, our aging nuclear arsenal. Outdated and underfunded, America's decrepit nuclear program could be one mishap away from catastrophe. How bad is the situation? The Pentagon recently admitted there are systemic problems across the nuclear enterprise. Thanks to arms control treaties and the end of the Cold War, the U.S. has reduced its stockpile of nuclear weapons from 31,000 to about 4,800 over the last 48 years. But as fears of nuclear war eased, the government failed to adequately maintain and update this immensely dangerous arsenal, which still contains enough collective destructive force to lay waste to every country on Earth. The U.S.'s 450 intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, are stored in decaying 60-year-old nuclear silos in Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming that look like a poorly maintained Cold War museum. The demoralized Air Force personnel safeguarding the weapons have been plagued by scandals reaching to the very top of the command structure, including drug rings, mislaid missiles, and widespread cheating on readiness tests. Today, the real nuclear threat to America isn't an enemy strike, said Air Force Lieutenant General James Kowalski. It's an accident. The greatest risk is doing something stupid. How old are America's nukes? The average age of a U.S. nuclear warhead is 27 years. Many of the buildings where the nuclear missiles and bombs are stored date back to the 1950s, and it shows. Blast doors on the country's nuclear missile silos are too rusty to seal shut. The roof of a security complex in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that houses most of the U.S. supply of enriched uranium, collapsed in March. For years, the three ICBM complexes had just one working wrench available to tighten the bolts on the missile's warheads. When the wrench was needed, the workers would FedEx it from one base to another. Today, the principal information technology used to operate and launch the ICBMs is an 8-inch floppy disk from the 1960s. Is the staff demoralized? That's an understatement. The Air Force officers spend long shifts in a hole underground waiting for a launch order that will probably never come, while their buddies from the B-52s and B-2s tell them all sorts of exciting stories about doing real things in Afghanistan and Iraq. Hans Christensen, director of the Federation of American Scientists Nuclear Information Project, told Mother Jones, that sense of frustration has led to trouble. In 2013, the Pentagon announced it was investigating a drug ring across six missile launch facilities. Then, when examining the phones of two Montana officers suspected of using ecstasy and amphetamines, Air Force commanders unwittingly uncovered a cheating scandal implicating 98 missileers. The officers had been texting one another the answers for the monthly exams, which test a missileer's knowledge of security procedures and classified launch codes. The institutional rot has led to a number of frightening near misses, such as, in 2007, six nuclear missiles went missing from a North Dakota facility for 36 hours. It turned out they'd been accidentally attached to a plane's wings and flown over several states to Louisiana, where they were left sitting unprotected on the tarmac for hours. A year before, four missile nose cones were accidentally sent to Taiwan instead of helicopter batteries. The most serious near disaster occurred back in January 21, 1961, when two nuclear bombs slipped from the belly of a B-52 flying over North Carolina city of Goldsboro. Both bombs were set to detonate and failed to do so after suffering minor damage to the parts needed to initiate an explosion, a stroke of luck that saved the city from annihilation. What's being done to improve the situation? Before announcing his resignation in November, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced $7.5 billion in extra funding over 5 years to cover management changes, training, and weapons upgrades. He was following the lead of President Obama, who has reversed his 2009 pledge to seek a world without nuclear weapons. Not only has Obama overseen the slowest five-year reduction of warheads in the past 20 years, but the president has also called for $1 trillion in nuclear modernization over 30 years, with a commitment to 400 land-based missiles, 100 new bombers, and 12 new missile-firing submarines. Some defense experts think he's foolish to try to maintain a vast nuclear force created for 20th-century superpower threats. It's not missileers who are at fault, it's the mission, said Joseph Siracione, a global security expert and author of the book Nuclear Nightmares. What do hawks say? They point to recent world events, such as the standoff with Russia over the Ukraine and the volatility of nuclear-armed North Korea, as a reason for America to maintain a strong nuclear deterrent. Still, former Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General James Cartwright, thinks the U.S. should eliminate ICBMs entirely and focus on smaller tactical nuclear weapons, such as plane-carried bombs. But for the foreseeable future, says Pentagon advisor Joe Braddock, the U.S. will try to keep its existing arsenal from falling apart. The interesting thing about a nuclear deterrent is that enough of it has to be visible to scare the living daylights out of the enemy, he says. But if you are not careful, you scare the living daylights out of yourself. And we'll take a look at a few columns now. First from the U.S. This from Eugene Robinson at the Washington Post. Presidential race needs new blood. In a nation of more than 310 million souls, we can do better, said Eugene Robinson. Can't we? Now that failed 2012 GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney is telling big bucks donors he almost certainly will run again in 2016, the race truly is devolving into a contest of retreads. The rationale for yet another Romney campaign would seem to be lacking. He promised in 2012 that he'd use his technocratic skills to reduce the unemployment rate to 6% over 4 years. But 2 years later, it's 5.6%, and the U.S. economy is the envy of the world. Romney's big competition among establishment Republicans is Jeb Bush, the son and brother of former presidents. Bush is a reasonable conservative who doesn't frighten independents. But does anyone think that what this country really truly needs is another Bush as president? Democrats, don't laugh too hard. Your only viable candidate thus far is Hillary Clinton, and people are sick of that political dynasty, too. Right now, this election looks like a contest of attrition among the tired, the shop-worn, the unviable, and the famously surnamed. And from John Fund at NationalReview.com, Jarrett's outsize influence. Valerie Jarrett may be the second most powerful person in Washington, said John Fund, yet Americans know precious little about her. An old Chicago friend of the Obamas, Jarrett has served as a senior advisor to the president throughout his 6 years in office, shielding him from criticism, keeping cabinet members and key congressional Democrats at a distance, and wielding extraordinary influence over Obama's decisions, policies, and appointments. Even other Democrats view her as the Rasputin of this White House. In researching his new book on health care in the U.S., author Stephen Brill concluded that it was Jarrett who kept frantic underlings from telling Obama that healthcare.gov, the Obamacare web portal, was not ready for its scheduled launch in October 2013. It doesn't help that Jarrett suffers from a severe case of hero worship, having told an interviewer that Obama has never really been challenged intellectually, and that he's just too talented to do what ordinary people do. How can someone in such awe of her boss possibly offer meaningful counsel? It's high time the news media paid more attention to Valerie Jarrett. And we have an international column from Nigeria. Ask the question, why can't the army beat Boko Haram? While the world was focused on the massacre in Paris last week, an apocalyptic horror was occurring in Nigeria, said Simon Allison in the Daily Maverick from South Africa. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram marauded through the northeast town of Baga, killing every man, woman, and child it caught. Over 5 days, refugees were hunted down and butchered. Eyewitnesses reported seeing roads lined with corpses and the body of a pregnant woman with her belly slit open. Up to 2,000 people were killed. Government troops at a nearby military base simply fled along with the civilian population. Then in the city of Maiduguri, some 120 miles south, at least 19 people were killed when a suicide vest attached to a 10-year-old girl exploded, possibly set off by remote detonation. These horrors demonstrate how little protection the Nigerian state is able to offer its long-suffering citizens. Our army has much to answer for, said Ola Audu in the Premium Times from Nigeria. Survivors from Baga say the town's civilian militia battled Boko Haram successfully at first before being ordered to withdraw by government soldiers who wanted to call in airstrikes. But the airstrikes never came, said one resident, and Boko Haram was able to storm Baga from all directions, shooting, killing at will. Why is Nigeria's military so inept when Cameroon's forces score plenty of victories against Boko Haram? Asked Punch from Nigeria in an editorial. When the militants crossed the border into Cameroon a few weeks ago, they were forced to beat a hasty retreat with the gendarmes hot on their trail. Cameroon used air power to chase the rebels deep into Nigeria and managed to kill about 150 jihadists. Our neighbor's triumph is proof that the Islamist terrorists are by no means invincible if only Nigerian soldiers can be made more efficient and combat ready. That won't happen so long as America refuses to support our troops, said Jibrim Ibrahim in the Daily Trust. Not only has Washington refused to sell us weapons, but it has also blocked us from buying arms from third parties. All the Obama administration is prepared to offer is training. The U.S. claims that's because its laws forbid it from supplying weapons to armies with a record of serious human rights abuses. Given the recent admission of CIA torture, this is disingenuous at best. But in any case, the U.S. has worked with the armies of Israel, Egypt, and Iraq, all of whom are widely known for violating human rights. So why not Nigeria? Whatever abuses our soldiers commit surely pale in comparison to the slaughter and torture Boko Haram is inflicting on our people. Our American friends need to come down from their moral high ground and help in the war against terror. Our in-depth article this week is titled, The Road to Radicalization. Born in France, the Paris killers grew up on the margins of society, said Angelique Chrysafis. Along the pathways of Paris's picaresque Buttes-Chaumont Park, with its hills, lake, and faux Roman temple, Sharif Kouachi, a local pizza delivery man, would regularly go jogging. Past the waffle stands, pavilion restaurants, picnickers, and children's play areas, there are always runners working up a sweat on the park's steep inclines. But Kouachi and his small group of jogging mates had a particular purpose. A criminal court would later hear. They were keeping fit for foreign jihad. The group of Parisian friends were all in their early 20s. Many had met at a local middle school. Most had poor school records and chaotic family lives. They came from deprived corners of the surrounding 19th arrondissement in northeastern Paris, a mix of gentrified apartment buildings, working-class streets, and a patchwork of high-rises troubled by gang turf wars. The dozen or so friends, mainly unemployed or in small jobs, were involved in petty crime, theft, drugs, trafficking, but then they met a young, charismatic guru figure at a local mosque. Also in his 20s, and only a year older than Kouachi, Farid Benyatou was working as a cleaner but holding discussion groups in his flat about fighting jihad. It was 2004, the aftermath of the Iraq War, and gradually the friends resolved to go to Iraq to fight the Americans. This little group, which in court was described as staggeringly amateurish, was deemed by Le Monde the first jihad school in France. After jogging sessions and a quick demonstration of how to hold a Kalashnikov, a handful of the friends had left at various points to fight holy war in Iraq. Three were killed. Others returned badly maimed, one minus an arm and an eye. Others were thwarted in their plans to leave by the French police. Kouachi, who scraped a living delivering pizzas for El Primo Pizza on the other side of the ring road that serves as a moat around Paris, was arrested in January 2005 on his approach. The more I wanted to go back on it, excuse me, on his approach to on his way to catch a flight to Damascus, believed to be ultimately heading for Iraq. He told the court he was relieved to have been stopped because he hadn't actually wanted to go. The more my departure approached, the more I wanted to go back on it, he told the judge. But if I chickened out, I was scared I would look like a coward. He got a relatively light prison sentence, 3 years with 18 months suspended, and there was little hard evidence against him except a plane ticket for Damascus. To lawyers, he seemed to be a fragile young kid with few real political ideas, psychologically manipulated into a sect-like group. After his release, he settled down and got a job on a supermarket fish counter. A decade later, Kouachi, 32, and his older brother, Saeed, 34, led the deadliest terrorist attack on France in 50 years, beginning by walking into the office of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and opening fire with Kalashnikovs, killing 12, including a Muslim policeman on the street outside. After a three-day reign of terror, the brothers were shot dead by police following a hostage drama north of Paris. In parallel, Amedi Koulibaly, 32, first shot a policewoman and then held hostages at a kosher supermarket in East Paris, killing four before police shot him dead. All three gunmen were French, from the Paris area, raised and radicalized there. The French government now faces serious questions about how men with convictions, jail terms, and a place on the U.S. blacklist slipped through the net. The government had said some 1,400 people living in France had joined the jihad cause in Syria or Iraq, or were planning to, and about 70 French citizens or residents have died in terrorist ranks in Syria and Iraq. But the radicalization of the Kouachis and Koulibaly began long before the Syria crisis. Sherif Kouachi was born in 1980 in Paris's diverse 10th arrondissement, which stretches from the Place de la République to the Gare du Nord. He was one of five children of Algerian immigrant parents. A source who knew Sherif Kouachi when he was arrested on his way to catch the flight to Damascus in 2005 said, "He was abandoned very young. It's not clear if his parents couldn't look after the children or if his parents died. But he was put in care homes early, before age 10. The care homes were far from Paris, and his childhood was described as chaotic. When he reached 18, he returned to the northeast of Paris with his elder brother. He had a sports education qualification, but a poor school record and no other family support. When he became involved in the Bus Chemin group of friends, he was back in Paris, but living precariously. He was living almost like a homeless person, staying with someone, but it was more of a mattress on the floor than a real home," the source said. "He was very clearly marginalized. He was immature, just out of adolescence. He wasn't vindictive. He went to the mosque, but went clubbing, made rap music, smoked hash, drank. He wasn't a hermit." It seemed at the time that Benyetu, the young guru figure by whom Kouachi was enthralled, used methods similar to those of a sect. He made him feel important. He listened to him, recognized him as an individual. Sherif Kouachi was fragile, looking for a family. He didn't have a family he could turn to for support, the source said. When he was arrested over the attempted flight to Syria and Iraq, Kouachi described himself to investigators as a ghetto Muslim, according to Le Monde. "Before, I was a delinquent, but after, I felt great. I didn't even imagine that I could die," he told the court. A French TV documentary on radicalized youth showed footage of him rapping. "It's written in the text that it's good to die as a martyr," he said. The Bus Chemin group jihadi aspirations were directly linked to the Second Iraq War in 2003. But they would sit in apartments watching footage of the U.S.-led invasion. "Everything I saw on TV, the torture in the Abu Ghraib prison, all that, that's what motivated me," one of Kouachi's friends later said at trial. But under Jacques Chirac, France had refused to intervene in the Iraq War, and the Young Cell's stance wasn't really a movement against the French state. It was more a rage directed against the U.S. Some of the groups stated that jihad wasn't done in France. The focal point was fighting a foreign invader in Iraq. "They were the pioneers of French jihadism," said Jacques Follereux, a journalist at Le Monde. "This was a group of kids with very little education, without a political project, inexperienced, desocialized, on the margins, delinquent, unemployed. In their mentor, who was their own age, they had a manipulator. They were looking for identity. When the young men were arrested, prison gave them access to a universe never known before. If the Bus Chemin was an informal school of jihad, prison was the superior diploma," said Follereux. Kouachi was held on remand in the notorious Fleury-Mérogis prison in south of Paris, a supersized decaying concrete mega jail that is Europe's largest prison. Built in the 1960s, it was supposed to be a model for incarceration, but became a byword for tension, inmate violence, drugs, suicide, and even the hostage-taking of prison officers. It is now being refurbished. But at the time Kouachi was placed there before a pending trial, it suffered over 150% overcrowding and Victorian conditions. In 2008, prisoners smuggled out video footage of the conditions, showing violence between inmates in the exercise yard, leaking ceilings, moss on walls, fetid toilets, birds nesting in the decaying walls, stagnant water, and freezing conditions. "Even homeless people are better off than us," one said. One of the prisoners involved in publicizing the terrible conditions was Amedi Coulibaly. He was an armed robber on his third sentence, this time for robbery, receiving stolen goods, and using false license plates. Coulibaly met Kouachi inside the prison, and they became close during 7 months on the same wing. Less than a decade later, Coulibaly joined the Kouachis in last week's terror attacks, killing a police officer and, later, four hostages in the kosher supermarket. Coulibaly, known as Doli, was born in France to parents from Mali. He was the only boy with nine sisters and grew up in a notorious housing estate, La Grande Bourne, in Grigny, south of Paris. Built as a 1960s social utopia, it had become known for poverty, drug dealing, arms trafficking, youth criminality, and attacks on police, as well as arson attacks on public buildings. If employers saw the estate's address on a CV, it was likely the job application would go straight into the trash. In 2005, France's suburban tower blocks erupted in the worst riots in modern French history after the deaths of two boys who had been running from police on the other side of Paris. But it was in Grigny that the tension of the riots escalated to a higher level, when youths on the estate fired the first gunshots at police. Like other troubled estates, the Grand Bourne had a youth culture of fast money, robbery, drugs, and guns. Damien Brossière, a lawyer in nearby Évry, remembers Coulibaly as a hot-headed and daring teenager whom he twice defended in armed robbery cases more than a decade ago. He said Coulibaly's father was from a modest background and had come to France to work in poorly paid jobs. Like many young kids in the area, his son didn't want the same life. He fell between his parents' model and the reality of life on the estate. In prison together, Kouachi and Coulibaly found not only friendship, but a mentor, Jamel Begal, who radicalized them. The portly Begal, serving a 10-year sentence for a plot to bomb the U.S. Embassy in Paris, had once been a regular worshiper at Finsbury Park Mosque in London and a disciple of the radical preachers Abu Hamza and Abu Qadada. He came to be seen by UK and French intelligence as one of Al-Qaeda's leading recruiters in Europe. When Sharif Kouachi left prison, he appeared to want to get his life together. He married and got the fish counter job on the outskirts of Paris. Ben Yetou, the Butt Shaman guru, later began to train as a nurse. Coulibaly got an apprentice contract at a Coca-Cola factory and in 2009, despite his criminal record, was one of 500 young people invited to the Elysee Palace to meet then-President Nicolas Sarkozy at an event about youth unemployment. But less than a year after that reception, police swooped in. They suspected a plot to free an Algerian Islamist, Sman Ait al-Belkamen, who was sentenced to life imprisonment in 2002 for a bombing at the Musée d'Orsay railway station in Paris in October 1995 that left around 30 injured. Begal's disciples were arrested over conspiring in the plot. Surveillance showed Kouachi and Koulibaly had been visiting Begal, where he was under house arrest in rural central France. Koulibaly would later take selfies on countryside training trips and photograph his partner, Hayat Boumediene, firing a crossbow while wearing a niqab. Boumediene, who had married Koulibaly in a religious ceremony, grew up in care homes outside Paris after her mother died and her father couldn't look after the family. She is on the run and is believed to have traveled to Syria. Kouachi kept silent during the police questioning. Because of a lack of evidence, the case against him was dropped. Koulibaly got 5 years in prison for the escape plot. He was described as a model inmate and was released in spring 2014. Boumediene was there to meet him, and they resumed life together. Less than a year later, he would be part of one of France's worst terrorist attacks in decades. A witness account from the kosher grocery holdup described how, after shooting four of his hostages, whose bodies lay where they had fallen, Koulibaly nonchalantly made himself a sandwich from the supplies in the store, telling the remaining hostages to do the same. This article was written by Angelique Chrysafis and originally published in Guardian News and Media Limited. We'll turn now back to the health and science page. Our first article there. At last, a new kind of antibiotic. For the first time in nearly three decades, scientists have uncovered a new class of antibiotics, a potential game changer in the war against infections that do not respond to standard drugs. Over decades of exposure, many bacteria have evolved to become resistant to existing antibiotics. These superbugs now cause 2 million in illnesses and 23,000 deaths every year. Up to now, researchers have had little success in developing new antibiotics. Nearly all antibiotics are derived from naturally occurring bacteria that produce their own antibiotics to kill off rivals. These bacteria are generally found in soil, but the problem has been that they won't grow in laboratory conditions. So researchers at Northeastern University developed a device that may finally allow them to access millions of uncultured bacteria as a source of potential antibiotics. The device is filled with tiny chambers that allow bacteria to be isolated while still growing in their native soil, enabling scientists to trick them into being domesticated. Of the 25 antibiotics they discovered, one, called Tyxobactin, proved to be highly effective in treating certain types of pneumonia, tuberculosis, and the staph infection MRSA in laboratory mice. Because of the way the new antibiotic works, by breaking down microbes' outer cell walls, researchers believe it could be decades before any resistant strains emerge. Here's an antibiotic that's essentially evolved to be free of resistance, said author Kim Lewis, tells BBC.com. He said the discovery, which may take 5 years to bring to the market, will provide a promising source of new antimicrobials and help revive the field of antibiotic discovery. And the bowhead's aging secrets. In an effort to find keys to longer life, scientists at the University of Liverpool have sequenced the genome of the bowhead whale, which has an average lifespan of 200 years. The research has so far revealed several mutations in the whale's genes that are thought to be connected with repairing damaged DNA, an insight that may help explain why bowheads and other large marine animals have such remarkably low rates of cancer. Other revelations from the bowhead genome may provide similar clues about the whale's cell cycles, body temperatures, and overall aging process. Different long-lived species use different tricks to evolve long lifespan, said lead researcher Wild Pedro de Magalhães tells LiveScience.com, by identifying novel maintenance and repair mechanisms, we hope to learn the secret for living longer. And the health scare of the week, mom was right about colds. For years, scientists have insisted that being cold doesn't make people more susceptible to catching a cold. The reason colds are more common in winter, they've maintained, is that infections spread more easily when people spend more time in crowded indoor spaces. But new research now suggests that feeling cold may indeed play a significant role in getting sick. The common cold is caused by the rhinovirus, which one in five people carry in his or her nasal cavity at any given time. Most of the time, the body's natural immune system keeps the virus at bay. But researchers at Yale University have found that when the temperature inside the nasal cavity falls by 5 degrees, the immune system is weakened and becomes less effective at preventing the germs from replicating. The study researcher, Akiko Iwasaki, tells the Daily Telegraph UK, gives credence to the old wives' tale that people should keep warm and even cover their noses to avoid catching cold. And on the Talking Points page, medicine forcing a teen to have chemotherapy. At this moment, said Brandy Zadronsky in thedailybeast.com, 17-year-old Cassandra C. is in a Connecticut Children's Hospital undergoing chemotherapy for Hodgkin's lymphoma. With it, her doctors say she has better than 80% chance of survival. Without it, she will die within 2 years. But Cassandra, whose last name isn't being publicly revealed, doesn't want chemotherapy, which she calls poison. When her mother supported that decision, the state's Department for Children's and Family, DCF, accused her of neglect and took Cassandra into custody. This experience has been a continuous nightmare, said Cassandra C. in the Hartford Courant. A group of shouting cops came into my house and took me to a hospital where I've been kept under constant surveillance for 6 weeks. Last month, I was strapped to a bed and sedated. When I woke up, there was a chemotherapy port implanted in my chest. I care about the quality of my life, not just the quantity. This is my life and my body. This is not an isolated case of intrusive medical overreach, said Lauren Cole in Inquisitor.com. A growing number of mostly teenage patients have been mandated by government to undergo aggressive treatments despite personal, religious, or philosophical objections. Chemotherapy is, in fact, poison, and it fails to save patients at least 20% of the time. No patient should be forced to accept its brutal side effects without his or her informed consent, and no parent should lose custody to overzealous medical professionals intent on forcing unwanted treatments that aren't guaranteed to work. But Cassandra's refusal isn't even based on coherent ethical or religious objections, said Arthur Kaplan in NBCNews.com. She's refusing chemo, her mom says, because she hates the way it can make her look and feel, nauseated, tired, and bald. At 17, Cassandra is still a teenager, a group not known for always making the best judgments. Yes, but will her judgment suddenly improve when she turns 18 in September? Asked Mark Berman in WashingtonPost.com. Cassandra will then be free to decide for herself what, if any, further cancer treatments she wishes to endure. In her letter to the Courant, Cassandra asked, how long is a person supposed to live? Who determines that? The answer is not her, at least for another 8 months. And another Talking Points article, Community College, Free for All. President Obama has unveiled his latest gift horse for taxpayers, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In a bid to expand access to higher education, the giver-in-chief has proposed making community college virtually free. Under Obama College, tuition fees would be waived for students who attend two-year programs at least half-time and maintain a 2.5 GPA. Washington would pick up 75% of the tab, conservatively estimated at $60 billion over 10 years, while states would cover the rest. Obama's latest entitlement wouldn't really help the poor, most of whom already get community colleges, averages $3,300 tuition picked up by Pell Grants, and would add tens of billions in new taxpayer obligations. This handout would cheapen the value of a two-year degree, said Scott Shackford in Reason.com. To secure their free money, colleges would have to keep students from dropping out, so they'd make it easier for students to pass. Before long, community colleges would be churning out graduates with associate's degrees they can barely read. The odds of a Republican Congress passing an Obama proposal on any issue aren't very high, said David Leonhardt in NYTimes.com. But his community college plan, which is based on successful programs in Chicago and GOP-run Tennessee, should be the exception. In a globalized high-tech economy, education has a return on investment like nothing else, and the entire country could benefit. The genius of Obama's proposal is that it would lure more middle-class students to community college, said Richard Kallenberg in TheAtlantic.com. The two-year colleges now have sparse funding and weak academic standards because of pervasive low expectations for their poor Black and Hispanic students. Strengthening these colleges with an influx of middle-class students would attract new funding and turn them into engines of social mobility they were designed to be. And we will take, to finish up here, a quote from author Cormac McCarthy, quoted in BuzzFeed.com. He says, "You never know what worse luck your bad luck has saved you from." Something to think about. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. As always, if you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.